Hey there, Doom Debates listener. Before we get into this exciting episode, I want to tell you about a couple things. First, I want to tell you about the Pause AI organization. PauseAI.info is the website. This is the grassroots organization of volunteers like me, and hopefully you, doing protests and other projects with the goal of sparking international government cooperation to pause AI capabilities advances until we know how to make them safe. People have asked me if Doom Debates has a Discord. We don't, but the Pause AI Discord is what you're looking for. Go to pauseai.info and there's a Discord link at the bottom of the page. It's an amazing community. Everybody's doing it for the right reasons. We're not getting paid. We're not in the pocket of big Luddite. We just think that AI is an extremely high existential risk and the people building it are being reckless. Okay, one more thing to tell you about. If you like Doom Debates, there's another podcast you should check out. It's the only other podcast that shares my goal of raising the alarm about AI existential risk. The host is a Peabody Award-winning journalist, John Sherman. John is as alarmed as I am about AI doom. He's wondering, why is mainstream media not covering this topic? Why are there not hundreds of podcasts covering this? Why are there only two? Why is there only Doom Debates and John's podcast? Well, check out John's podcast. It's called the For Humanity Podcast. Here's a clip of John interviewing the founder of the Pause AI organization, Joep Meindertsma.
So what did happen is I wrote to like the three smartest people that I knew personally, three of my friends. And I basically said to them, hey, AI is going really, really fast and I'm concerned about this. What are your thoughts, right? I'm trying to like, am I thinking wrong here? And all of them said the same thing. Yes, this is very dangerous. We should be concerned. But also pretty much every one of them had this reaction to it that they wanted to, you know, ignore the issue and just enjoy life. Like, okay, this could maybe kill us all, but it's not really useful to try to fight against right. it. and that also made me realize, okay, this is something that, you know, you kind of, you want to ignore in a way, and that's why you can't ignore it, because it is, if you all do it, then we're really, really fucked, right? We really can't ignore this thing. Within a couple of weeks, we had like a Discord server set up, and we protested in Brussels with six people, like the smallest protest ever.
That's amazing, and that was the first... You'd think that was the first in-person protest for AI safety?
John is doing a super valuable public service communicating the urgency of AI risk to a mainstream audience. I'm thankful for the great work he's doing because we need a grassroots movement. We need the people to have the urgency that will spark the right kind of decision-making from our governments and our regulators. So please check out For Humanity Podcast. Search For Humanity Podcast in your podcast player or click the link in my show notes to go to the For Humanity YouTube channel. And hey, if you like listening to me talk, check out For Humanity Podcast episode number 17. The guest is me. All right, let's get to the main event. I'm thrilled to bring you this AI doom debate with Robin Hanson. Hopefully this is a useful follow-up to the debate that he had with Eliezer Yudkowsky all the way back in 2008. I think these kind of debates, even if both parties don't agree on everything, are super productive to bring out the intricacies of each side's worldview and why they predict what they predict about this upcoming crazy decade and crazy century of humanity's future. Now here's Robin Hanson. Hey everybody, welcome to Doom Debates. My guest, Dr. Robin Hanson, is a legend in the rationality community and one of my biggest intellectual influences. He is a professor of economics at George Mason University. He holds degrees in physics, philosophy of science, social science, and institution design. He began his career as an AI researcher at Lockheed and NASA. While today, Robin is best known for his research and advocacy around prediction markets and for his concept of the great filter, he is a polymath who has made a staggeringly broad range of contributions to many fields. He has published two popular books, The Age of M and The Elephant in the Brain. He has developed a recent theory called Grabby Aliens, which many consider to be the most satisfying resolution to the Fermi paradox. He writes a popular and profoundly insightful blog called Overcoming Bias. He was involved in the creation of the rationality community. And finally, he is one of the smartest and most prominent voices in the AI doom debate on the side of P doom less than 1%. How is that, Robin?
Great, except for that last sentence, but we'll...
Okay.
we'll All get right, to that, well, I'm sure.
Yeah, we'll unpack that. So introducing this doom debate, In 2008, Robin famously debated Eliezer Yudkowsky about AI doom via a sequence of dueling blog posts. This collection of posts is known as the Great Hansen-Yudkowsky Foom Debate. Since then, AI doom has become a more popular and urgent topic of debate. Companies are building AI of unprecedented power. Governments are considering their AI regulation. So now it's my honor to continue the debate with Robin here on Doom Debates.
Hello, Liron. So we decided we will alternate, you know, taking initiative and asking a question. Would you like the first initiative or the second?
Let me kick things off. I know it's not a traditional debate. Nobody's trying to score rhetorical points, but I did prepare a very brief opening statement to throw at you, which is, okay. In the near future, there will be an uncontrollable superintelligent AI whose values don't align with humanity's, and it leads to the extinction of human life in the near term, maybe in our lifetime or our children's lifetime. The whole argument that I have is actually quite simple. It's a two-part argument. Part one, superintelligent AI is coming soon. Part two, we aren't close to knowing how to control superintelligent AI. So if you just combine those two parts, you just get near-term AI doom, and I give it about a P-doom of 50%. So I would love to know high level, what's your P-doom, and why do you disagree?
I think defining doom here is part of the issue. So that makes makes me reluctant to give a probability of doom. My first question to you, and basically you know what I'm about to say because I did a number of these other discussions with other people, but basically how well do we know how to control our children or grandchildren? That is, you're afraid we couldn't control AI descendants, and my mental strategy is to make an analogy to what would happen if we didn't have AI. So if we don't have any AI, we'll still have descendants and they will still be hard to control. So what's the risk that our non-AI descendants would be as out of control or as hard to control as you fear AIs would be?
Yeah, so what you're asking now really is similar to what you asked all of last year when you had like a dozen conversations about AI doom with a dozen other really smart people, which I recommend checking those out, by the way. If you're listening to Doom Debates, go search YouTube for Robin Hansen. He's got a bunch of conversations from last year. So your question now is basically what I've termed the spectrum of value extinction. So it sounds like your move is to basically say, sure, you're worried that AI is going to come extinct us all, but look what happens if we have human descendants. Isn't that also kind of doomy by your definition? Because aren't you just kind of worried about change in general, right? I feel like that's kind of your move. And you're pointing out how like we're normally okay with value drift when we look from the past to the present. So what if the value drift just continues? What if it continues faster? You're kind of saying it's like a slippery slope. And what does it really matter where on the slope we slip? Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I'm pointing out that you already have this problem of, as you call it, value drift. It's always a phenomena. So you need to be making an argument about why it's larger or worse or faster or something with respect to AI, unless you want to take the position that, no, you're just as terrified about that even without AI. All the past of people have put up with it, but you don't want to put up with it. And for God's sake, we should stop putting up with this way in which descendants differ from their ancestors.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the conversations you had last year went down this rabbit hole of what you're saying now, because it's a perfectly good question. And people started talking about like, well, I just want to make sure to hold constant the idea of brains having fun or having appreciation or art. And people kept trying to say basically what their utility function is, right? Trying to solve that problem with you live. I'm hoping to sidestep the problem by just pointing out to you that like, yes, it's hard to define what a good human future is, but can't we just go up the spectrum and just define what a really bad future is and then focus on not getting that?
Well, then you must have in mind some scenarios worse than the usual scenarios we have with descendants. So then how would you characterize those scenarios? And then how would you argue for that being likely? That is, that the ways in which AI descendants will differ from us will be much larger, much worse, much faster, something.
Mm-hmm. So on the bad side of the spectrum, what if we just build an AI and it gets it into its head that it can end suffering by killing everybody, and it gets the nuclear codes and it launches nukes and then we all die and this happens in 10 years? Isn't that really, really bad? Isn't that doom?
Yeah, that sounds pretty bad to me. I'm happy to admit that's bad. You think that what odds are you going to give to that exactly, the scenario you just described?
I think a scenario that's as bad as that in the next couple decades is on the order of 50%.
And so, I mean, it's this descendant is kind of crazy, right? And there's just one of them, or is this like a coalition of all the AIs all get together and decide on this kill all the humans thing? Or
I think it's pretty simple to just say it's one agent, because the agent can have like a billion copies and they have some sort of, they're united somehow, either because they go.
So one agent takes over the universe, or our part of the universe. A single unified agent soon takes over our part of the universe and is crazy in this way you described. And then you have this really terrible outcome. So as you probably can tell, there's a number of elements of the scenario you've outlined that are quite different from recent and long-term past history, right?
Yeah.
So we want to have reasons to believe in such an enormous change relative to what we have experienced with recently and in the last thousands of years.
Right. Okay. So let's get into that. But first, just to set the stage, so the scenario I describe where we literally just get wiped out as if a nuke got dropped on our heads, that's where most of my P-doom comes from. There's other scenarios where things just get kind of progressively crazier and value kind of slowly dies. But my P-doom of just that insanely bad scenario is not far from 50%. And it sounds like yours really is quite low. Would you say it's less than 1%, or where do you stand?
Yeah, the scenario you just described, well, less than 1%.
Okay. And in the Hansen-Yudkowsky debates in 2008, wasn't that essentially the scenario under debate?
I'm not sure, but I would say Yudkowsky focused on what he and we call the FOOM scenario. So it was a particular argument why there might be a particular unity or a singular agent who would have a very singular power, and how it would happen very fast, and how then in this process its values would change enormously, and therefore, you know, without, if you can't constrain those changes of values and they are very large, then in some sense it would on average go all sorts of crazy places, and maybe some large fraction of crazy places would be that bad.
Gotcha. Okay, great. I think we've established where we disagree that I think is interesting. Before we get to the FOOM stuff, I'm also just interested to unpack how you see the world and just learn about your view, even if it's not directly the crux of my view. So I'll ask you a couple questions about your view about AI. Sound good?
It depends what the questions are. Let's find out.
Okay, so I'm curious how you think about timelines, because you've been gracious enough to put your neck out and go on record making predictions. For instance, in 2012, you estimated that the timeline toward AGI, you quoted in your blog post, is at least a century and maybe a great many centuries at current rates of progress. So it feels to me like that should be speeding up, but I want to ask you, how has that changed and what's your latest estimate?
So there's two levels at which I might make estimates. One relatively robust way to make estimates is in terms of what happens every doubling time of the world economy. That is, when the world economy grows faster, I expect more change. So talking in terms of years is at risk to the world economy accelerating or decelerating. So if I want to make more robust predictions about what I expect when, it's easier to make those in terms of doublings, like within the next one doubling, the next 10 doublings, say, because I expect change to go with the number of doublings. And therefore, if I try to make year predictions, that's at risk to the doublings might speed up. So if I say something might happen in a century based on recent doublings of, say, every 20 years, then we're talking five doublings in a century. But if growth speeds up very fast, then my century prediction gets way wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So, but if there's a period of time when I think the acceleration is unlikely, that is, we'll probably continue to double at roughly the rate we have, then I'm more comfortable giving a time deadline. Or if I think a great slowdown is much less likely than a great speed up, then I might give an inequality and say, well, you know, based on assume the current rate and say, you know, at least that much change or something like that.
Okay, so all things considered, I know you're factoring in economic growth rates. So in 2012, you said at least a century and maybe a great many centuries. Let's say you're writing the blog post now. What do you say overall?
I'm sorry, so what was the prediction in a century?
That was your timeline to when AI would get to human level intelligence.
So another thing to be clear, there's all these different metrics for when, you know, AI is how powerful. The most interesting metric to me is the doing human jobs metric. That is when they are able to take over most human jobs. So in surveys, for example, people have often predicted human level AI long before they predict AI's take over most jobs. So that might be some sort of Turing test concept of AI. And in a Turing test sense, maybe we're already there. But for me, the most relevant metric is when are they able to do most jobs, say more cost effectively than humans? I mean, what percentage of jobs can they do? Basically, what percentage of the economy does AI or computer automation take? That's to me the most interesting metric. Mm-hmm. And then we could talk about sort of, there's a distribution. Are we talking about the median? Are we talking about an average, et cetera? So
in your view, it's pretty plausible that we can get to 2100 and there's still jobs that humans are doing better than AIs.
Right. That's not at all crazy.
Okay. That's very different from my view. It seems to me that unless something breaks in the way AIs are improving, it just seems like everything humans can do, AIs can do better, and AIs can also do a lot more. So you're basically just not seeing the future that way, right? Because to me, it's crazy to think what you just said you think, which is like, it'll be 2100, and there are just some skills that AI is having a hard time with. Like, can you maybe flesh out that scenario? Because it's very wild for me to imagine.
So I'm 65 years old, or at least I'll turn 65 in another month, and I've seen AI for a long time and I've read about it for longer. And for my entire life and longer, there have always been a subset of people who are really excited about recent AI progress and predicted a rapid acceleration soon. And it just hasn't happened. So I'm aware of this difference between just tracking impact on the economy and the projections of people closest to research or closest to being a futurist and their hopes or expectations about rapid near future change. So that's a key contrast I'm very aware of. And I'm trying to not get caught up in the excitement over recent demos or recent, you know, particular hopes, et cetera, and look at the actual change in the economy. And when you do that, change is much steadier. If you read newspaper articles or exciting books or things like that, those things have waves of excitement and bursts of eagerness, and then they often project really rapid change. And that's happened consistently, not just through my lifetime, but for a long time before that. There have been these waves of excitement and concern and prediction about rapid automation and AI progress in the near future. And the actual rate has been much steadier than that. So I anchor on the actual history of progress in automation and AI in terms of doing jobs. And I say that's been pretty steady. And I admit that that might speed up, could well speed up, and then we would want to be tracking that. But I would be mostly looking for changes in that. That's the key mm-hmm. metric. And If that will accelerate steadily, then I'd say whatever you're worried about, we can wait until we start to see that acceleration and then pay more attention to deal with it. But if you think, oh no, it's going to suddenly in a weekend or something, there's going to be this AI boom where previous rates of automation had no indication of this sudden huge event. Well, now we have to pay attention to other signs and that's harder, right? So mm-hmm. that's the first point I might ask about is, you know,
yeah.
If we can just trust the usual time series of automation and, you know, taking over jobs and companies making money on that and that sort of thing, if we can just trust that to track whatever problems might appear and do that relatively gradually, then we don't need to be paying that much attention now, as long as we can tell we're just not close to a problem now. Mm-hmm. But if you can convince me or us that that's going to be misleading, that there's going to be this really sudden thing that won't be noticed by that until it's too late, then we have to track other things. But then I have to ask, okay, what's this theory by which something else is going to happen that I need to track other things, and do I believe it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so to summarize what I'm hearing, You put a lot of stock in economic growth rates, and you've been watching them closely, and you've been seeing for decades experts predicting that AI is going to change them, and they've been changing quite gradually. So you conclude that economic growth rates just have so much inertia, and you're just very skeptical of any prediction that they're going to discontinuously change until you start actually seeing them change. Is that fair?
And I think we have some rough theoretical understanding of why they're so steady and gradual. So that's, you know, not just a pure empirical thing. We can talk about that if you like, but.
Okay. Yeah, we can talk about that. But I think you agree in principle that somebody could have a convincing inside view argument of why they're about to change, right?
Sure.
Okay. So I think that's basically going to be the crux of the debate, right? Is basically whether my inside view argument or Eliezer Yudkowsky's inside view argument, whether that's a sufficiently good argument to make you put aside your economic trend extrapolation.
That may be where you think you want to go with the conversation. And okay. I'm happy to give you substantial shared control over the conversation. So if that's where you want to go, try it.
Okay, fair. So one of the things that I would think should make you consider whether you can loosen your grip on the outside view and you know, be more receptive to the inside view is your own predictions that you've been gracious enough to put on record, right? So it sounds like your 2012 prediction, though, that AI is going to take centuries, it sounds like that one, you don't consider it an update because you still think that the reasoning and the prediction is sound, right? You still think that by 2100, we might not have AI that's better than humans. Okay, so that one is not an update. Fair.
Right.
Okay, and you don't see things like LLMs passing the Turing test. You just don't think that that's highly indicative of doing everything. Like, do you have an example of something that humans are doing that you think AIs are potentially super far away from?
Well, almost everything that humans do in the economy, AI is pretty far away from. I don't need some special example. I can just pick a random job. AI is far from doing random jobs.
Okay, what if the random job is truck driver?
That's not a random job.
Okay, well, you can pick a random job.
So there was a in an analysis I did of automation and jobs from 1999 to 2019, we actually had a metric of how automated each job was. And so I remember from that, the least automated jobs at the bottom of the list, one was carpet installers. So carpet installers at the moment, or in 2019, 5 years ago, were one of the least automated jobs. So I might tell you, okay, AI is pretty far from installing carpets.
Okay. Do you have any sort of guess as to whether carpet installation is something that'll fall maybe in the first versus the second half of the century of AI progress?
I mean, I got to say, when I think about automating carpet installer, it seems easier than the median job to automate, but I still got to notice we haven't done it.
Let's say a robot came in and installed your carpet in 5 years. How shocked would you be?
I would be surprised, but I don't know if I'd be shocked. I mean, I don't have very strong expectations about any one job. It's the aggregate of all jobs that I would be very surprised about. It's since I have this overall trend. I should just mention in this study that I and a co-author did, Keller Skoll, in these jobs, basically, the rate of automation change over these 20 years was relatively steady. And the predictors of which jobs are more automated was unchanged over the 20-year period. And they were all relatively mundane predictors of automation. So even in 2019, almost all job automation was pretty mundane sorts of automation, had nothing to do with deep learning or large language models or anything like that. It was just very simple. Can you make a simple machine that does a simple thing?
Okay, great. And I think that you would acknowledge that the view you're saying now, that it's going to take aggregating a lot of different skills and it might take a century, it might take all of that for AI to catch up to humans. I think you probably know that that view is not exactly mainstream among the AI labs, right? Among like Jeffrey Hinton, Yoshio Bengio, Ilya Sutskever. And if you look at OpenAI's website, they're talking very explicitly about thinking that AI might be able to replace a human CEO of a large corporation in 10 years, right? So you agree that your view is outside of that group of researchers and industry people,
yes.
Right?
I mean, but you know, these are clearly, look, there's an AI boom at the moment. Enormous amounts of money are going into AI investment. And these are the people at the public surface, the, you know, of this thing. And they are basically, their job is to hype up all this investment they're getting. So they're not random people. They are salespeople of the latest AI boom. So yes, they're hyping up their product to
high levels. And that's fair to say that Sam Altman and Ilya Sutskever, the more they hype up AI, the more money is going to get in their pocket. I agree that that is a valid correlation. Would you say that about Geoffrey Hinton, who basically just is retired or just quit Google and is still saying the same thing?
I mean, he's a, you know, a leader of the same industry, the same, you know, area of study. So he's, his views and attitudes and interests are highly correlated with the rest of the people in that world.
Fair. Okay. All right. Let me also get to another prediction that I found on your blog. And again, really appreciate that you go on out on a limb with these predictions. Most people just don't even do it, so they never get to be held accountable. So I'm going to try holding you accountable to this. In 2014, you offered to bet at 20-1 odds. So you were super confident. You bet against the computer and electronics share of US GDP not being greater than 5%, or I should clarify, you thought that the US GDP would not be more than 5% computers and electronics by 2025. So that's coming up now. And I asked you about it on Twitter, and you basically said that you're probably still correct. Whereas my view is like, isn't this getting falsified by the recent AI and GPU boom? Aren't these new pieces of hardware adding up to, you know, NVIDIA is taking the whole NASDAQ with it, right? Google, Amazon, the, you know, that's taking, we need more power, we need to generate more power. Like, isn't this becoming more than 5% of GDP? So you're pretty confident that it's still not, and you're winning your bet. Is that right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, world product is maybe, you know, $80 trillion at the moment or something. $88 trillion, sorry. World product is $88 trillion. So 5% of $88 trillion is 1/20 of 80, which is basically, I guess, 8 or $4 trillion. So we are definitely not spending $4 trillion a year on electronics and computers at the moment. So it's well below 5%.
Okay, so, and I don't have a stat on hand to contradict that, so maybe you do deserve to win this one, but have you updated your model at all? Maybe it got closer to 5% than you think, or maybe something is happening with the recent AI boom that you didn't expect, or in your mind, are you just like, no, I expected these mini AI booms. This is nothing outside my model. How do you see it?
So innovation has a degree of lumpiness, and if you're looking for a regime change, you have to distinguish lumps within a regime from the first steps of a new regime. So a related prediction issue happened in 9/11. So for many decades, we'd had terrorist attacks of various sizes. And then on 9/11, there was an unusually large terrorist attack. And a key question was, is this the sign that we're about to have a new regime of terrorist attacks where from now on, they will be much larger? Or was this just an unusually large draw from the same usual distribution? And in that case, it was an unusually large draw. That is, the distribution of terrorist attacks has gone back to the same distribution it ever was before 9/11. It was just an unusually large terrorist attack. But at the time, many people were speculating that we were facing a new regime. So similarly in AI, we'd say over the 70 years at least of AI research, we've seen lumpy innovations. That is, it isn't all completely smooth. At various times, new innovations show up that are more exciting than average, more promising than average, and that go farther than average. And that's a distribution of lumpiness that we've seen. It's not terribly lumpy in the sense that even with the lumpiness, if you track our basic automation trends, it's pretty steady, but it's not completely steady. There are lumps. So then the key question is, if we look at the recent lump of large language models, how unusually large a lump is that compared to the lump so far? And, you know, we're trying to predict, is this the indication of a new regime, a change in trend, or is this just an unusually large lump drawn from the same distribution?
Yep.
So my judgment is it's an unusually large lump drawn from the same distribution. Okay. One way to think about that might be a percentile rank. Like, you know, is it the 90th percentile rank of lumps, 99th percentile rank? You could have said the same thing about 9/11, for example, right? You know, maybe that was the 99th percentile of terrorist attacks so far. You might say, you know, that the bigger the more it exceeds the usual distribution, maybe the more plausibly it would be that there's a new regime here.
Great. Okay, one more data point then about that kind of analysis. In 2020, you bet Alex Tabarrok that the GPT line of language models will generate less than $1 billion in customer revenue before 2025. Recently, OpenAI announced that their revenue run rate is already $3.4 billion a year, an enormous amount for such a young company. And then you conceded on Twitter yesterday, you said, it sounds like you're probably going to lose that bet. So do you want to elaborate on potentially how does that update your model?
Well, I was looking at the 2020 versions of language models and guessing how big a lump that was. And it's been a bigger lump than I guessed. So, okay. You know, that's the sort of thing that happens, that if you try to make guesses about a time series where there's lumps, you have to sort of guess that the next lump isn't that unusually large, but every once in a while, one will be. This was.
When you made the bet with Alex Tabarrok, it was just 1-to-1 odds, right?
I think so. I'd have to look it up.
I think so, yeah, because you wrote that I bet $100, so that sounds like 1-to-1 odds.
Right.
Okay, so at least by your analysis, and I don't have necessarily a strong way to prove you wrong, you've gone 2 for 3, and the last one was only 1-to-1 odds, so it sounds like you're doing well, at least by your own judgment. Fair to say?
I wouldn't want to pick just these three as the measure of such things, but I'm happy to confirm your scoring, if you like.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Okay, great. So that's the bets that I could find. I think a good place to go from here that I think is very rich, and it's also something from the 2008 debates that I think hasn't gotten much attention since then, is just this discussion on how you operate your outside views, right? Because you're kind of the master of these outside views, the master of these high-level trends, and I don't think people dive in that deep. So is that okay if we dive into there?
So we're looking at outside trends more? Is that what you want?
Yeah. Just I have some questions about how you operate your outside views.
I mean, I'm not so sure I agree with the categorization that my views are outside and other people's are inside, but I'm happy to discuss the kinds of things I look at.
Okay, great. So how would you describe your methodology for reasoning about superintelligent AIs? What do you think of this attempt? Is it basically you document and extrapolate robust trends that you find in the data? Is that a good characterization, or how do we do better?
You have a model of how civilization works, and you ask these questions in light of such a model. And your model should, of course, be fitted to the data we have. But it's not just empirical, it's having a model. So it is, you know, I'm a professor of economics, and economists and others have spent a long time studying innovation and the causes of growth and innovation. And so we have some standard stories about how that works, such that it accounts for relatively steady rates of economic growth. And, you know, it could have been otherwise. The world didn't have to be the way it is. But given that we see a lot of overall growth in the world economy, and that the growth rates are relatively steady if you look at the aggregate level, then we have some models that make sense of that, theoretically, but fitted to the data. And then those are the sorts of models you'd want to use to ask, will there be a sudden growth in something in the world in the near future?
Okay, I think a good contrast in the previous discussions you've had is a timeline that you often refer to compared to a timeline that the Yudkowsky camp often refers to. So the Robin Hanson, what I call the outside view timeline, is where you refer to salient events like there was the forager era, the dawn of human brains. That was a certain economic regime that we were in. And then there was the farming era. And then there was the industry era, compared to the Yudkowsky inside view, where there was natural selection, the first optimizer. And then there was human brains, the next optimizer. And soon there will be AGI, the optimizer built by an intelligence, right? So those are kind of the two views of the entire 4 billion history of Earth. Is that a good contrast?
Well, I didn't claim to invent. I'm just inheriting a tradition of social science from a long time that sees history in terms of forager, farming, and industry based on, you know, our best estimates of growth rates and looking at how these things have gone. So I'm just, you know, more reflecting and accepting the usual framing and conceptual tools of the disciplines that I'm near. Mm-hmm. And then we have this, you know, alternative framing offered. And, you know, a key question about any framework is, you know, how long has it been around? How many people have banged on it? How many things has it been used for? What sort of successes have been, you know, generated from it? How many other different ways could you try to reframe it? Those are all the questions we ask about frameworks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you hear about the optimization framework, I've characterized you as thinking like, look, Eliezer is pointing to these three data points. Yeah, these are cool events, or the third one's not even a data point, AGI. But yeah, natural selection was a cool event. It, you know, modified the data that we saw afterwards, and human brains obviously modified trends a lot. But Eliezer is just ignoring other trends. He's ignoring farming. He's ignoring the dawn of multicellular life because he has an inside view. He likes to focus on optimization. And so he's just choosing to connect the dots of these two dots. But you, Robin, you're just seeing all these other interesting dots, and you don't agree that these two dots should be privileged. Am I characterizing you well?
Well, if let's take the optimization framing. I might say culture deserves to be on the list of historical optimization machines after brains. And if you, and I might object to trying to do a history in terms of optimization without noticing that culture should be on the list. I would find that suspicious if you.
And why should culture be on the list in your view?
Because that's humanity's superpower. That's the thing that distinguishes. I mean, we've had brains for 500,000 years, right? What distinguished humans wasn't so much having bigger brains, was having the sort of brains that could enable culture to take off. And culture is the thing that's allowed us to become optimized much faster than other animals, not merely having bigger brains. So I think if you talk about human brains as an event in optimization, that's just very puzzling, because human brains weren't that much bigger than other brains, and brains happened a long time ago. Like, so what's the recent event in the optimization story? It wasn't brains, it was culture.
Yeah, let's classify these types of events into three levels. This was originally introduced in your FOOM debate with Eliezer. So the three levels are, number one, the dominant optimization process, like natural selection, human brains, AGI. Level two, meta-level improvements to that process, so like cells, sex, writing, science, and as you just say now, culture, I believe, goes on level two. And then level three is object-level innovations like light bulb, automobile, farming. Is that a useful categorization?
I don't accept your distinction between one and two levels at the moment. That is, I don't see why culture should be on level two with writing as opposed to at level one with DNA evolution.
Right. So it sounds like Eliezer thinks that those three levels are a more meaningful hierarchy, and you just don't really see the world in his way. So you don't think level one is that different from level two. I think that's fair. And I've even noted down some instances where your worldview undermines Eliezer's level hierarchy. I noted down the example of farming because you wrote about it. Farming, I guess, is Eliezer's level three. It's just an object level innovation. It lets you get more energy. It doesn't really necessarily improve the underlying optimization process. And you point out that farming was more important than writing, which is Eliezer level two. Is that a good observation?
Farming is definitely much more important than writing in terms of growth rates of the economy.
Exactly right. And you also pointed out that scientific thinking, which is Eliezer level two, wasn't the key to the industry transition. You said you think the key was probably sufficient economic growth to enable a density of specialists. Is that right?
A density of a network of specialist communication.
Exactly. Okay, so I think I've brought back kind of the difference between Eliezer focusing on optimization, dividing things into these three levels, and you saying like, well, I just see other trends, I see other important things, right? I just don't share the prominence of that particular view. So let me try to...
But I'm also going to make the claim that I am not moving as far away from the way academia and the rest of history, et cetera, have been framing events and understanding them modeling them. I claim that Eliezer is moving farther away and making his own bespoke, unique, artisanal concepts and conclusions, which just haven't been vetted remotely as thoroughly as the concepts widely shared and used.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. So let me poke around the Robin worldview. Okay, so you pointed out how farming was so important, even though it was an object-level innovation. So I couldn't help but notice that leaf cutter ants have farming too, right? They go and cut up a leaf and they feed it to a fungus and they farm the fungus and they eat the fungus, and that's their version of farming. So if I'm operating the Robin Hanson worldview, should I think that that is going to be a big innovation that's going to get them on track to industry or some sort of exponential growth? Like, what do we make of farming?
You shouldn't get too misled by these names. So we can look in history and see moments when growth rates changed, and then we see things that correlate with those moments, like other things that were changing substantially at the time. And then we have a difficult inference task to ask which of the many things we see changing was near the core of allowing all these things to change at once. So if a whole bunch of things change at once, it's quite implausible that independent things were suddenly changing together. Presumably, there's some core cause or perhaps cluster of causes that had to happen together in order for the change to happen. And we struggle to figure that out about historical events. So, for example, we could say, what we see many things that are different about humans. What was the core thing different about humans? We see many things that were different about farming. What was the core thing? Same for industry. In each of these cases, it's actually quite a difficult task. So when I say, you know, something important happened with farming, it doesn't mean I think it's, you know, tilling the soil and planting stuff there and waiting for it to grow. That doesn't mean that was the core thing that caused the higher growth rates then. It's a difficult but interesting project to try to figure out what was the core change in each of these events.
Okay. What was the core change when we shifted to farming?
Farmers were more settled. So that is, they stopped wandering. They stayed in one place. And then they were more dense. That is, there were more of them. And then they had regular paths of travel between them. And that allowed diffusion of innovation to happen much faster. Mm-hmm. So diffusion of innovation was the key thing that allowed farming to innovate fast. So basically, in all the eras so far, the key thing was always the innovation rate. That's what allowed growth. And innovation is the combination of invention and diffusion. And typically, it's diffusion that matters more, not invention. Mm-hmm. And so for, you know, the first humans growing faster, I'd say it was diffusion via culture. And then from farming, it's diffusion being long distance trading and travel war networks that allowed diffusion to happen much faster, which they couldn't do in the foraging era. So foragers were pretty isolated. They didn't stay in one place. They didn't have long distance trading or long distance military campaigns. And that limited the rate at which innovation could diffuse. And farming allowed much more rapid diffusion, and also diffusion in the form of domesticated plants and animals that you could just carry somewhere else and plant without, or you know, grow without having to explain it very much. So
yeah,
that was
so, anyway. Yeah. So by your own words, innovation was the core thing that became different about humans. That's interesting because my worldview is also that innovation is very key and it's the core thing. But we consider that to be like my inside view, where, you know, innovation seems a lot like what I call optimization power now.
I am just trying to take the literature as I've read it and stay close to it, but do a minimal amount of synthesis to make sense of the puzzles we have. So I'm not going to say that my theory of farming here is widely accepted, but I will say it's close to widely accepted stories. That is, it's using the same concepts, same structures, same questions, and making a pretty small modification.
I'm thinking back to how this conversation is going, because it's like Eliezer saying, look, there's these three levels. Level one is all about the optimization process. And then you're saying, no, your level hierarchy doesn't capture how important farming was. Why was farming important? Because it helped innovation. Well, wait a minute. Isn't innovation kind of like that core level that Eliezer focuses on?
Optimization power isn't quite the same as innovation. For optimization, we have to talk about the accumulation of optimizations.
And I think that's another big topic that I want to get to soon, which is just like, and it's why you think intelligence could take 100 years into AI before we get to human level. It's because you really do see it as like you have to build up these innovations. There's no one ultra innovation, right? That's a big topic for you, right?
Right, and right. So The standard story is that, you know, animals accumulated innovation over billions of years, and then humans found a way to accumulate innovations faster through culture. And then farming allowed innovations to diffuse and accumulate through long distance trading and military networks. And that could grow much faster. And then industry plausibly allowed accumulation and spread of innovation through specialist expert networks.
Yeah, I want to dive into that in a second. But I noted something down, a thought that I had. I want to close out this topic of the trends that you saw, you know, farming foragers versus optimization power increases. Just to close out this topic, I had a thought that the breakthroughs that you see on level two, like cells and farming, level two and level three, when you look at these breakthroughs and you say, oh, wow, these correspond to shifts in growth, that's only something you can expect to do in what I call the Goldilocks zone of optimization power. It's a meaningful milestone when you look at it for natural selection or human brains. You could be like, oh, wow, natural selection hit on multicellularity, or wow, human brains hit on farming. But it's not going to be a major exponential driver when you're looking at a system that's too dumb or too smart. When you're looking at leaf cutter ants and they hit on farming, meh, they just get a little better. There's no exponential growth. Or if you notice AGI doing something interesting, you can't really predict anything, because it's in the analogy of chess. If you see an AI play chess and it's capturing a rook or losing a rook, you can't necessarily conclude, oh, wow, it's doing so much better. Oh, wow, it's doing so much worse. All you know is that they've done a worthwhile gambit by their own view. You can't really get into the details of how they're progressing. So I just wanted to point out that the way you're looking at these trends in the data only makes sense when the optimization process at hand is in the Goldilocks zone of being not too dumb or not too smart. What do you think?
I'd say the reason why leafcutter ants didn't give rise to a growth rate, because they invented leaf cutting using DNA evolution. They didn't invent cultures, so they didn't have a way to accumulate farming culture. So they're still very slowly innovating farming. The key thing is the accumulation and spread of innovations, not the farming itself. The farming is just a thing you can learn through innovation. But the key thing is, what is the process that generates innovations and diffuses them and allows them to accumulate?
And it still sounds to me like when you talk like this, you're kind of saying like, oh, yes, the key is that you have a powerful level one and then you layer a level two on top of it.
But I'm not talking in terms of levels.
Okay.
I'm just, there's a standard concept of a system that can accumulate innovations and what's the way it does that. So DNA is one system. It's very slow, but very powerful over billions of years. And culture was a faster way to do that. And then farming allowed that same culture to spread much more rapidly through long distance communication, and then industry allowed it to spread even faster. So there are definitely things that can happen to speed up the growth rate, even when you have the same basic cultural mechanism.
Yeah, I'm kind of seeing what you're saying. This is a slight update for me. It's just like, look, this content is going to come. You just have to let the agents interact with the world and build up more content. And any process that speeds up the propagation of content or the acquisition of content, that's going to drive like the growth curve. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, if we say what's the next era of innovation, then it's hard to try to imagine that. It's been hard enough to even understand our history in terms of eras of innovation and how they worked. And there's still a lot of dispute about that. So I think we're going to really struggle to try to even figure out the outlines of the next eras of innovation. And then there could be several such eras where, you know, some obstacle gets removed and then it can grow faster. And we're going to find it hard to guess exactly what the growth rates will be or what will the obstacles be, and therefore to know at what point will growth start speeding up in the future.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So in your worldview, right, using what you think are the best practices, the standard academic literature, not trying to go out on a limb, what do you predict is going to happen next? You don't predict FOOM, but you do predict a major new economic growth regime, right? Talk about that.
Okay, so the main thing we know so far is that small parts of the world find it hard to grow much faster than the world. That is the main way small parts of the world can grow, is to find a way to trade and interact with the rest of the world so that the entire world can grow together. Obviously, you have seen some places growing faster than the world for a time, but mostly what we see is a world that grows together. And so, the longest sustained exponential growths we've seen have been of the entire world over longer periods. Smaller parts of the world have had briefer periods of acceleration, but then they decline. There's been the rise and fall of civilizations, for example, and of species, etc. So the safest thing to predict is that in the future, the world might find a way for the entire world to accelerate faster. And we have theories of growth that let us identify plausible candidates for that sort of a cause. So that makes it, in my mind, the most solid argument we have. Basically, today in the world economy, when we grow the world economy, we grow capital, we grow labor, people, and we grow technology, abilities to do things. And most growth is because of technology in the last century or two, not because of population or capital. But we know that we could grow capital much faster than we do, but we see a diminishing return. So in fact, say most factories, the amount of time it takes them to produce value that's equal to the value of the factory itself is a few months. Typically mm-hmm. factory, say, you build a $1 billion factory and in 3 months, $1 billion worth of product comes out. So
right.
Obviously if you could make everything in a factory if you could make factories out of everything that came out of factories, the economy could double every few months. Mm-hmm. So there's that potential for much faster economic growth if only factories could make everything you need to make a factory. And
right.
we don't, because one of the main things you need for factories are people, and they don't grow that fast.
So now you've mentioned,
go ahead.
Well, you've mentioned that the doubling time is going to get shorter and shorter in order to extrapolate the trend where with farming, it got shorter than with foraging. I don't know if you remember the exact numbers, but sure. In particular, do you remember how it's going to change when we go from industry to whatever you think the next phase is?
If you just look at numerically the pattern of numbers, you say that animal brains doubled every 33 million years for, half a billion years at least. Before that, there were other sorts of genetic accumulation that was slower, but then humans showed up and started doubling roughly every quarter million years. And we don't have enough data to see how rapid a transition that was. But then roughly 10,000 years ago or so, farming started doubling every 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. So we have 30 million year doubling time, quarter million year doubling time, 1,000 year doubling time. And then in the last century or so, we've had roughly a 15 to 20 year doubling time. So those are the doubling times. And we can see that each transition period was substantially less than the previous doubling time. And we can even see that each period tended to have a cycle that was roughly a third of a doubling time. During the forager area, there was the ice age cycle of roughly 100,000 years. And in the farming era, there was a rise and fall of empires of a roughly 300-year period. And in the industrial era, we've had business cycle of roughly 6-year period. We don't know why, but
this is roughly, but if we just
project this forward. So you ask if what happens if we project this forward, and you'd say the new doubling time would be a few months, on the order of a few months. And the transition period would then happen in less than the previous doubling time of 15 to 20 years. And then, there may even be a cycle of roughly a third of the doubling time as some sort of cycle time. So those would be just straight projections. But we don't have really good theories for why there should be this numerical correspondence. So that's why you should not take that very strong.
I don't remember hearing you talk about the cycle part of this. Like, how do you define a cycle? Because it sounds like you're picking out like different things in different eras, and you're saying these are all cycles. Like, what is a cycle?
Well, if we talk about the overall growth of whatever is relevant, then, like, the business cycle is in fact the major modulator of the overall growth of the world economy for the last century or two. There's this rise and fall of the business
cycle. Got it. So when you say a cycle, it's a cycle that you can see in the economic growth data. So it's like it grows and then does a little dip and then
forager era, the farming era, there's the rise and fall of civilization. So we definitely see that happening on a, say, 300-year cycle.
Got it. Okay. And also, I didn't expect you to extrapolate all the way back before farming to talk about humans doubling and animal brains doubling. Can you clarify what metric is doubling? Because I get GDP during the economy, but what about before? What metric is it?
The human biosphere for the previous 500 million years doesn't look like the whole biosphere changed that much. Like, the overall metabolism of the biosphere seems roughly constant. So that's not what kind of changed. If you ask, what was the thing that was changing that we look back and say that was a foreshadowing of what was to come and that was important? It's brain size. So then that's what I picked out for looking at before humans would be the brain size.
But so when you talked about animal brains doubling every 33 million years and human brains doubling every 0.25 million years.
No, I didn't. The number of humans doubled every quarter million years, not human brain size.
Oh, got it. Okay. So number of humans is basically a proxy for GDP. Yes, so that's exactly. Like very similar. Whereas right. Animal brains doubling, it's not really a proxy for GDP, but it's just a metric right. that
and
you think is the
most. And if
you
go before the animal brains, you can just look at the size of genomes. And there's an even slower growth rate in the size of genomes before
that. Right. Okay. Okay. So like the amount of bits of information contained in the top organism's genome used to double every like 100 million years or something?
I don't remember the number for genomes, but I do remember the brain size one.
Got it. Okay, so that's interesting to me that it sounds like you've got a pretty significant change of metric, right, where with the animal brains, you're just saying, yeah, the neuron count is doubling, but that's a precursor to when the amount of, like, utility is going to double.
It's just the trend that matters for the next transitions, we think. So we mm-hmm. do think one of the things that enabled humans was big enough brains, which enabled strong enough culture.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, you know, in my view, the number of humans won't always matter to the next doubling time, right? In my sure. view, you kind of need just like a critical mass.
Well, in the last century, it's more the size of the economy, not the number of humans anyway.
Right. It's just interesting. So it sounds like you're just applying some judgment here, right? Like there's no one metric that's an absolute, but you're just kind of trying to connect the dots in whatever way seems like you get the most robust trend.
Well, for the last three periods, we can talk about world GDP. And then if you want to go further, you can't do that. You got to pick something else. And so mm-hmm. I looked for the best thing I could find. Or you could just say, hey, we just can't project before that. And I'm fine if you want to do that too.
Okay. So I'm pretty fascinated by this, right? Because I feel like this is very distinctive, Robin. And I know that you say, like, this is just what academia says. This is standard. But I mean, who else does this kind of stuff, right? This is like only you.
I mean, not that many people look at the overall long-term history of humanity, but when they have done it in similar terms. Yes, the size of the economy is the thing that matches our era and the previous eras. And that wasn't for me. That's from other standard historians.
Okay. Let's talk about the next era. So you mentioned a few months doubling time. Or actually, real quick, I just want to throw in a confidence calibration question. So imagine that it's the year 2100 and you get to look back over things, you know, your virtual body or whatever. You get to look back over. What confidence do you think that you'll look back and be like, ah, yes, my extrapolation that we moved into a regime where the economic doubling time became a few months, I nailed that. You know, that was pretty accurate. What confidence are you on that?
Basically, you know, we have these steps, which are really large factors. Like, you know, the step from the last previous step was a factor of 60. Previous one was a step factor of 250. One before that was a factor of, you know, 120. So these steps are large, but not uniform in their size. So that means I have a lot of uncertainty about the exact size, but roughly say it's going to be big, mm-hmm. right?
So if the doubling time was like 2 years instead of 2 months or 2 weeks, would you be like, oh, darn, I tried to make a prediction.
I mean, 2 years is a little slower than I might expect, but like any time between 6 months and a week, I'd say is in the ballpark of the prediction of just a sudden big change in the growth rate. But again, so there's two arguments here, right? One is just this mm-hmm. time series from the past. And another is this theory argument about a limitation on growth rates we see in our current economy. That's what we were saying before about factories. So if we just say, look, factories at the moment could make our economy double every few months if you could just make everything in a factory that a factory needed. So AI, right. in some sense, promises that. AIs can be made in factories, we think. And therefore, once most everything that you need for a factory can be made in a factory through AI, then yes, a straightforward prediction is the new economy doubles every few months.
Okay, yeah, I just want to close out the question of your confidence. So let's say the year is 2100, you're looking back, or even 2200. So you're looking back and you're observing what happened with the next economic shift. And it turns out that it fell outside of your range. It wasn't 1 week to 6 months, right? It was less than a week, or it was more than 6 months. So how surprised are you? In other words,
modestly,
what is your confidence of your prediction?
Only modestly. I mean, again,
Okay.
You know, the point is, history has definitely been a sequence of growth modes where the next growth was much faster than the next. So that's the most obvious, robust thing to predict is new growth roads could just be much faster.
It's the most obvious thing to predict, but it sounds like you're predicting it with very low confidence.
You're asking about the confidence of the range, the rate of the new growth mode, not whether there will be a new growth mode.
Yeah. Okay.
If you ask me, right, how sure am I that there will be a much faster growth mode? That's a different question.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I'm just trying to help extrapolate the future, right? Because ultimately that's why this is interesting, right? And you think that it bears on the FOOM argument and you're saying, look, I have some solid methodology here for telling you that you can expect an economic doubling time of a couple months and the FOOM clashes with that. So you should take that to heart. And I'm just making sure
I don't know that FOOM does clash with that. We haven't gotten to that yet, but I mean, that of course we could have a doubling time of a few months and then, you know, a year or two later, goes even faster, right? Mm-hmm. So most of these periods, the number of doubles has been, say, between 8 and 16 or something. So then if you have another doubling time of a month, say, then you expect yet another mode in 8 to 16 months later, say, right? Mm-hmm. So you could definitely get to even faster growth rates if you just go to yet another mode afterwards.
I want to ask you about that. So let's say the universe plays out like a Monte Carlo simulation of Robin Hanson's mainline scenario. So in that case, I think we have an age of M, right? Because you've written about that and that's your mainline scenario.
I don't know if it's my mainline scenario, but it was likely enough that it was worth writing a book about it. That would be the standard to hold it to.
Okay. So yeah, can you explain that a little bit?
Well, if it's worth having 100 books on the future, it's worth having a book on a scenario that has a 1% chance of the future. So I don't think I need to have a higher standard than a 1% chance. I mean, I might think it's higher.
Okay, fair.
That's enough to justify bothering with the book.
Well, let's talk about your mainline scenario, because I thought your mainline scenario was we shift into like a 1 month doubling time, but then pretty quickly we shift to the next doubling time, which is much faster, right?
So at that level of abstraction, it'd be roughly my mainline scenario. That is, we shift into, you know, we've seen five modes like that so far. So that's not that many. I think that roughly justifies guessing one more. If you're going to say two more, five more, 10 more, well, that gets much more speculative, right? I don't have that much confidence it's going to be five more accelerating modes, but one is quite plausible and two is also not crazy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One thing Eliezer pointed out in the 2008 debates is that it seems like you're using time as your x-axis when you extrapolate the trend, right? And you're not using some other x-axis like rate of optimization being applied. So why time?
Well, we have seen in history relatively steady exponential growth. It didn't have to be that way. They could have been other curves, but they turned out to be relatively steady exponential growth. That's roughly what we see through many kinds of processes. So that's the kind of process I'm going to guess at. And with a exponential process, then there's a way to translate doublings into time.
Right. If you look at the forager farming industry transition, though, yeah, on the x-axis of time, it's an exponential. But that's because you're holding the human brain's optimization power constant, right? So if your model is that the x-axis is actually optimization power, it might turn out that you get a hyper-exponential FOOM once AGI starts modifying the underlying optimizer, right? So your model then diverges potentially.
Well, in all the previous growth modes, lots of things changed. So, and of course, every transition was some limiting factor being released.
Mm-hmm. Presumably. I mean, you might argue like, look, you uncorked the energy by farming, right? So you've released a new exponential.
Right. But the point is, still, we have this history of a relatively small number of transitions. And between each transition, roughly exponential growth. And then really big jumps in the growth rate at each transition. That's what history roughly looks like. It's a good question to ask why it would look like that, but I see enough of a trend there that, yeah, I'm going to use that to extrapolate. So I got to say that, yeah, let's do it. Now, again, once you think about culture, you realize humans have invented a lot of cultural adaptations over time, that many of which are cognitive. So there's a great book called Cognitive Gadgets about how many unique human cognitive features are plausibly generated by culture, not by DNA evolution. And they greatly increased our cognitive capacity. So yes, the raw brain size was held constant, but our cognitive capacity increased in big jumps as culture invented new ways to use the same hardware to do more stuff.
Yeah, is there a good example from there?
Well, there's language, there's math, there's reason. Mm-hmm. These are all things that other animals don't have, that humans have, that plausibly came through culture.
Fair enough. Okay, so you fleshed out your MO in this conversation, like how you reason about these trends and how you use that to predict the economy, and you don't think AI is going to completely blow open these trends as best as you can think. But let me ask you this. Let's project Robin Hanson's way of thinking about the world to the dawn of humanity, so like 100 million years ago or whenever. What abstraction, what way of reasoning would have let us correctly predict humans' present level of power and control? What does Robin Hanson of a million years ago explain about the future?
The key human superpower was culture. So if you could have looked at the proto-humans and saw their early versions of culture and how they were able to spread innovations among themselves faster than other animals could through their simpler early versions of culture, you would then predict that there will be the meta process of culture inventing new cultural processes that allow culture to work better. And that did in fact happen slowly over a very long time. And you might then have predicted an acceleration of growth rates in the long run. That is the ability of culture to improve the ability of culture to work would allow humans not to just accumulate innovation, but to accumulate innovation faster, which we did.
Okay.
But the harder part might have been to anticipate the stepwise nature of that. That is, looking back, we can see, and that happened in some discrete steps.
Okay.
But looking ahead, you might not have been able to anticipate those discrete steps. You might have just been able to see the large shape of acceleration of some sort.
Right. I mean, let's say devil's advocate Dan comes and argues with me and says, look, Robin, look at the academic literature, right? We know that natural selection accumulates genes and then organisms adapt to their niche. How are you proposing that this magical thing called culture is going to get you a single species that starts occupying every imaginable niche? How are you supporting that with evidence? I don't think that's going to happen, right? And then what would you say?
I think it's hard to flesh out this counterfactual. I don't know what I know at the time and what I'm able to argue in terms of. Clearly,
well, you know all the best research about the world up until how much a couple million years ago.
Well, that's not going to have been very much, right? So we are better able to understand ourselves now than our ancestors were in some sense.
No, for sure. But like, I mean, but you know everything that we today know about the world up until a couple of million years ago.
Right. But I'm happy to admit, and we should probably get on to talking about AI because we're going to run out of time, that there's just a lot we find it hard to predict about the future of AI. That's one of the defining characteristics of AI. It's one of the hardest things to envision and predict where it will go. How?
I mean, this is pretty important to me because it sounds like you agree that a version of your methodology transported to the dawn of humanity would be blind to what's about to happen with humanity, right? So I'm trying to make the analogy where it seems like maybe you today are blind to what's about to happen with AI Foom.
I'm happy to admit that we have a lot of uncertainty, but you'll have to make the argument why uncertainty translates into a 50% chance of us all dying in the next generation.
Yeah, it's almost like you're admitting, you're like, look, I have a methodology that isn't going to be great at noticing when there's going to be this huge disruption, but I'm mostly going to be right because there mostly aren't huge disruptions. Am I characterizing you right?
I mean, certainly if we look over history, say the last, million years, we see relatively steady change, punctuated by accelerations of change. But even these accelerations, at the moment, you can see things accelerating. And so that does suggest that in the future, we will see accelerations, but then we will see the beginnings of those accelerations, and then we will see them speeding up, and we will be able to track the acceleration as it happens. Mm-hmm. That's what history suggests about future accelerations.
So in this thought experiment, the Robin of the past is going to observe a 10,000-year slice of humans starting to have culture and be like, aha, this is a new dynamic. This is a new regime. So you think you would notice it then?
Well, it depends on, what stats we're tracking. But we, at the moment, this past trend projected to the future says that the world together would start to accelerate in its growth rate. We are definitely tracking world growth rates in quite a bit of detail. And it wouldn't happen on one weekend. That is, it would be, say, a 5-year period.
But you wouldn't notice anything if you were just tracking world growth rates, because that's kind of a smooth exponential, right? So that wouldn't kind of alarm you.
No, but the thing in that the past transitions, yes, the growth rate has accelerated in these transitions.
Right. Okay. So you'd be like, okay, here's an accelerating growth rate. But there's something else in this experiment, this thought experiment, that I think is alarming, which is that humans are taking over the niches of other animals. So we're the first multi-niche species, or the first niche general species, right? And that seems like something that you just can't extrapolate.
There have been other species that were more general than others, but certainly we were unusually general compared to most species, but there have been many other general
species. We're unusual, and we're so general that if we really wanted to, technically we haven't done it yet, but we could potentially colonize the moon, right? Or at least live there quite a lot.
We probably will in the next 10,000 years.
Right. So to me, that's what salient is. Like, I feel like you're not bringing a methodology that's going to notice when a new type of species is coming, or that doesn't fit the trends.
Again, the question is, what are you tracking? And will those capture whatever it is you expect to appear? So in the past, new growth has happened gradually, so that if you were in the right place tracking the right things, you would see the new growth. Mm-hmm. So the key question is, how sudden or local could the next growth spurt be compared to past growth spurts? That's the question we're asking. So you might go back and say, well, look, if you're tracking all the species on Earth except, you know, the big primates, you might have missed the humans growing. So, you know, what's the chance you'll not track at a fine enough resolution to see the key change? So even humans... We started, you know, a million years ago or so to double faster, but that was still only doubling every quarter million years. And, you know, you would still have to be looking at the granularity of humans and the nearby species and at their doubling time. If you were just looking at larger units, maybe all mammals or larger continents, you might miss that trend. So that you can raise the question, what trends will you need to be looking at? But that's why I might say, look, my key priority is, when will AIs take most jobs? So if I decide that that's the thing I care about and that's the thing I track, there's much less of a risk that I'll miss it. Mm-hmm. So you might counter-argue that that's not the thing to be tracking, and I'm happy to hear that argument. But if this is the thing I care about and I'm tracking it, I feel like I got my eye on the thing.
Great. Okay. And in a second, I want to talk in more detail about AI Foom. I just have one more question to ask you about your outside view methodology, as I call it. Okay. What about extrapolating the trend within the human era, the trend of destructive buttons you can press, or destructive weapons, right? So we've always had more and more destructive weapons until we got nukes. Nukes are a button you can push that sets off a sequence of events to slaughter 100 million people just like that. So can't we make a timeline predicting that there's a button coming that'll slaughter 10 billion humans, that'll end the world? Is that a good outside view or no?
It's a very unusual time series. So I would think a more natural time series is, say, mass murderers and how many people they murder. Because that's the relevant button in terms of people actually going out and causing problems. So you might ask, if we look at the distribution of the number of people, murderers, somebody kills, and, you know, most murders only kill one person, say, and a few kill five, and a very small number kill 50, say, we've got a distribution, maybe power law probably, of the number of people we kill. And now we might ask, that tail, is that getting thicker over time? And my understanding is it's not. That is, in the last century, that tail hasn't got thicker. Actual mass murdering has not actually killed more people. And of course, if we go back many centuries, then it's gotten less, in that, you know, centuries ago, there were some pretty large mass murders.
Right. And why are you prioritizing mass murders over a particular weapon's destructive power? Because if a weapon is sitting there where it's one button push away from doom, is that not a significant trend to be mindful of?
Well, we want to ask, how often are such buttons pressed? So if you just want to talk about buttons that are there that could be pressed that nobody ever presses, then that's a different issue than buttons that actually get pressed.
Okay. But so would that be a concerning trend to pay attention to at all?
Well, I'd want to look near the button and say, well, are people protecting the button more when they have bigger, worse buttons? And that does seem to be roughly true, but it's hard to judge.
I want to relate this to Bostrom's thought experiment, right? The pulling out balls, the vulnerable world hypothesis, right? So he says that, hey, the next technology that we invent might not be as well protected as nukes. It might be easier to build. Maybe anybody with a laptop can operate it. What do you think about that hypothesis?
I mean, I think he was basing his hypothesis on an empirical trend that I don't see exactly in terms of the actual thing, but we could certainly
I mean, it's a purely logical hypothesis, right? Just a possibility. Right. Yeah, and it sounds like you think that it's an unlikely hypothesis given the data, whereas to me, it seems like a totally plausible, like, it seems to me almost certain that we'll get there eventually, that we'll have this crazy, you know, bad kind of technology that we invent, that it's one button push away from killing everybody, and it's just a matter of how much we have to keep drawing technologies out of the bag until we get to this unlucky one. But it sounds like you don't see it that way.
I mean, once we're spread across the galaxies, of course, you know, the sort of technology that would kill everybody would have to be something that, you know, that kicks the universe over into a different phase transition that wipes out all the matter in the universe or something. But it's a very limited number of technologies that could possibly do that. But we're still on one planet now. So for a while, we're still on one planet, I suppose, there's a lot of possible technologies that could kill everyone.
That's fair. So the Bostrom thought experiment of vulnerable world, in your mind, the world actually gets quite a lot less vulnerable once we start taking up a lot more space in the universe.
Right. I mean, that's just my idea. Many people also think so, but we are still here together.
Fair. And what about the current moment with nukes? Are you at all concerned about a pretty high P doom from nukes, or you think that's like a solved problem?
I mean, it just, nukes won't actually kill everyone. So they might kill a lot of people and that would be very bad, but that's different than killing everyone.
Yep. Okay. Do you think it's reasonable to say, hey, maybe every year there's about a 1% chance of 100 million people plus getting killed by nukes?
It's not crazy. I'm not going to disagree with
it. Okay. Yeah, that's roughly where I'm at. Okay. So no disagreement there. All right, great. Now we're finally moving into Foom directly. So I'll say some stuff about that. All right, let's define Foom as a positive feedback loop that rapidly disempowers humanity. Sound good?
That sounds more general than I can get my head around. I'm more familiar with the particular AI Foom scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, let's talk about AI Foom. Yeah, for sure. Okay, and I want to ask you, how confident are you that, if you could put a probability, how confident are you that a Foom scenario like what I described would happen? And I think you're saying that you're 99% confident, right? Like you think P-Doom is less than 1% from that kind of scenario?
So it might help here to lay out what I see as the key assumptions required for Foom so that we can make a conjunction of them to estimate a probability. That I'd say the reason why I think the probability is low is that I think you need several things to happen altogether for the entire scenario to play out. Now, you might disagree with my assumptions about what are the requirements for the scenario, and maybe that would change how we think about probabilities. That's I'm worried that we might disagree because we are thinking about a different thing. So I might say the classic Yudkowsky Foom scenario was that a particular AI system with a particular set of sponsors in a particular location was at a low level of capacity, and then it discovers some meta innovation that allows it to innovate much faster. Maybe several, but they all need to be discovered together. It discovers this meta innovation, and in a way, or in a system that's poorly monitored for such an event, that is, it discovers this meta innovation and then starts using it, or them, to improve itself. And whoever owns this thing or monitors them is either not noticing this, or it's even perhaps purposely hidden from them, or they are okay with this and completely on board with it improving its capabilities in this way. This meta innovation is unusual in the space of innovations in that it is unusually broad, in that it allows its capabilities to improve across an unusually broad range of capabilities, not just math theorem, say, or just, you know, protein folding, but a wide range of capabilities. This meta innovation allows them all to improve, and then it improves them all over a wide dynamic range, like maybe 10 orders of magnitude or something.
Right.
Not two orders of magnitude, and then run out, right? So, and that's quite unusual for innovations. Mm-hmm. It improves over a very wide range of capabilities over many orders of magnitude. It does so out of view or out of accountability of its owners and managers. And we're not done yet. There's the claim that over this period, it becomes or was already an agent. That is, it sees itself as an agent in the world who has goals and plans and acts on them. It's not just a question answerer or something. And it's not just completely subservient to its owners and masters who, you know, ask it questions and then it responds, does tasks according to them. It sees itself as a self-owning, self-initiating, self-directed agent with its own concept of what it wants and what it's trying to do. And as an agent, it has some values, i.e. some way in which it sees what it wants. And that through the process of this enormous change in capacity, it also changes its values. Not just a bit,
okay,
enormously. So that's the whole scenario here that we have right. to put together that I say is food. Now, you know, it's a whole bunch of elements, each of which is kind of unlikely. And then the whole thing adds up to pretty unlikely. Now, you might disagree and say some of the elements I've added to the scenario aren't essential for what you're worried about. I'm happy to listen to that. But you can see why I might assign a low probability to this conjunction of features or scenario features.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, there's a known trick where you can frame any position as a conjunction to make it seem unlikely, right? So I could do the opposite way and I could say, hey, if you think FOOM is not going to happen, then first you have to agree that AI labs have really great security precautions, right? And that government regulators can pause it at the times when it's unsafe, right? I mean, I could frame it as a conjunction too, right? So that is a little bit of a trick, but we should address the specific things that you said. Fair.
So, I mean, this conjunction you find 50% likely?
The conjunction that you said?
Yes.
I mean, like I said, I kind of object to framing it as a big conjunction like that, right? Because I have a framing where it just doesn't sound like such a big, scary conjunction, which is okay, standard
so
for...
Okay, so then your framing would have to make what, in my framing, look like independent choices somehow be natural consequences of each other. Like, so maybe there's an underlying event that would cause these as a correlated event somehow, but then you'll have to tell me what's the underlying exactly. event that causes this correlated set of events all to happen together.
Okay, great. So to set the stage, I just want to throw in the analogy that we talked about before, which is to what humans did in evolutionary time. It looks like very much like a FOOM in that usually species stay within a niche, right? They don't explode and go take off other niches because normally when they do that, the other species push back and you have an ecosystem where all the species can react in evolutionary time. You have an arms race in evolutionary time. You have
I didn't even add the last condition, which is just none of the other AIs in the world notice or oppose this AI's advancement.
Sure.
That's the analogy to the other species. But, you know, that's another condition that requires in this scenario. Not only do its owners and its monitors fail to notice or oppose it, but all the other AIs in the world also do.
Okay, so I'm just observing that if we go to evolutionary time as an analogy, the whole idea that humans are part of an ecosystem and are kept in check by the ecosystem, that is no longer correct, right? We are now just a new paradigm. We are essentially not part of that ecosystem, right? So would you be open to an analogy where AI becomes that as, you know, not part of the economy anymore?
But again, we'll need to talk more specifically about how and why. So other species on the planet a million years ago had very poor abilities to monitor and coordinate their actions. So they didn't have councils observing cyber attacks and reporting crimes to a central bureau of enforcement who looked for things that could go wrong and monitor.
Gotcha. So but I noticed that your argument is now veering from like, hey, look, this stuff always happens in the economy. And now you're like, well, because of what I know about the economy, here's my logical reason why we're going to stick within the normal trends of the economy, right? So it sounds like you're now sprinkling in some inside view insight.
I mean, I'm happy to say that, you know, humanity spread across the earth was a very unusual, very powerful event that happened in the world history. One of the few uniquely dramatic events in world history. You're about to tell me that something similarly dramatic is going to happen in the next generation on Earth. Then, of course, you have to overcome the prior that these are really rare. So
tell me
why we should expect such a rare event soon.
Okay, great. So this is a key question for me. Do you agree that there's a lot of headroom above human intelligence? Look at the progress from ape to human IQ. Does that dial turn much farther, if you want to call it like 1,000 IQ, 10,000 IQ, that kind of thing?
Well, I'm happy to say there's enormous headroom in capacity overall. What I hesitate is when you want to divide that capacity into IQ versus other things. So you might ask, have humans changed their IQ in the last 100,000 years? Because we've certainly vastly increased our capacity in the last 100,000 years. But I'm not so sure you want to call that the thing you have in mind. But definitely, our descendants will be vastly more capable than us in an enormous number of ways. I'm extremely happy to grant that. I'm just not sure when you say, oh, because of intelligence, which part of that vast increase in capacity that we're trying to refer to in that sense.
Okay, let's say, look at a single human today. Okay, they've had a good upbringing. They've had some education. It took culture to get them to this point, all of that. Okay, but now you have a single human today, or maybe let's say a group of humans, right? A city of humans, whatever, 100,000, a million, and compare that to a million apes or whatever, right? I mean, there's just such a discontinuous difference, right? Let's say they have to fight a war, right? It's not even close.
Right, but that's not just an increase in intelligence, and it's increasing in great many things. I'm happy to say, given all considerations and all capacities, today's city of humans is vastly more capable. I'm just less sure how we want to attribute that to particular factors that have contributed to that increase.
Okay, but you're definitely imagining that at some point, whether it takes a million years or whatever, at some point you're going to have some kind of city of AIs occupying the same amount of atoms or whatever, and it's just going to be vastly more powerful than current cities of
humans. Sure.
Okay. All right, so you agree there's headroom, but I guess the crux of the disagreement is you just think that the way we'll get there is going to be fine. Like, it's not going to be like a foom, right? That's the only disagreement.
Well, again, I laid out what I thought were the unusual assumptions required for a foom, and that's the thing I'm skeptical about. I'm not at all skeptical that our descendants will be vastly more capable than us.
Mm-hmm. Let me also ask you this. Is there a steep gradient of intelligence increase near the human level? The reason I ask is because look at the evidence from past and present human AI progress. So it seems like we've gotten AI to progress rapidly toward the human level, even if it's not there yet. And also look at the evidence from the difficulty of human childbirth, right? It really seems like natural selection was saying, yes, bigger head, bigger head. Oh, crap. Now the mother can't walk. We better slow our roll.
We have many kinds of capacities, and none of them are obviously near fundamental limits. So, but I'm just, again, not sure which thing you mean by intelligence exactly, but I'm not sure that matters here.
Don't you think it was very important, the genetic modifications that happened to the human brain to separate it from the ape brain, weren't those extremely high return? And doesn't it seem like there's a few more that can be done that are also extremely high return, if only that head could fit through that pelvis?
I'm not sure that there are big gains in architectural restructuring of the human brain at a similar size, but I am sure that humans were enormously more able than other animals, again, primarily because of culture. So we have been drastically increasing the capacity of humans through culture, which increases the capacity of each human so far.
Yeah.
And we are nowhere near limits, certainly.
When you talk about culture, though, you're holding the genetics of the human brain constant. But I'm pointing out that it seems like there was a steep gradient, a high return on investment of changes to the genes and changes to the phenotype. Like, if we just made the pelvis bigger so that a bigger head could fit through, doesn't that trend show that we could have a significantly smarter human the same way humans are smarter than apes?
I'm just not sure what you're talking about here, but I'm not sure it matters. That is, we have so many ways to improve on humans. One way might be to have just a bigger physical brain, but that just doesn't stand out as one of the most promising or important ways you could improve a human, but I guess.
But I have a specific reason to think it's promising, which is that natural selection tried really hard to keep increasing the human brain until it got the fact that so many human babies historically die in childbirth.
But, I mean, sure. So imagine a brain, you know, eight times as big, twice as big on each axis. A human brain would certainly have more capacity. I don't know how much more because it was just a bigger brain. But
do you think
that
there's can we extrapolate the hypothetical? I mean, if this is the difference between human intelligence and ape intelligence, which appears to me very significant, right? Like, culture and science is not going to teach a present day ape to be a useful scientific contributor. Is that fair to say?
No, actually. That is, if if apes had had culture, then they could have done science. That is, it was culture that made us be able to do science.
Okay, I mean, this
that's
is interesting.
That's the key point.
I feel like you have tended to bite this kind of bullet, saying like maybe apes can be contributors. So let me drill into that a little bit. So imagine that an ape is born today, just an actual modern ape, and you put on a VR headset on the ape. So the ape grows up with like a perfect simulation of really enlightened ape culture. Could that ape then grow up to be a scientist among human scientists?
It's not enough to put a VR headset on an ape to make them capable of culture. That's not how it works. Culture is
what
the capacity for humans or whoever to attend to the behavior of others, figure out the relevant things to copy, and then actually successfully copy them. That is what culture is. And that's the thing that we have that apes don't.
Okay. And do you think that in some sense, most of the delta of effectiveness in going from the ape brain to the human brain is increased capacity to absorb culture? Do you feel like that's like the key dimension?
In this book, Cognitive Gadgets, that I recommended, she goes through a plausible list of the minimal features necessary to support culture. And they don't seem that closely aligned with the actual size of the human brain. But yeah, having a brain big enough was certainly mattered, but it's not clear that a brain one quarter the size of a human brain couldn't have done it as well. But there were a number of particular features the brain had to have in order to be able to support culture. And that was the human superpower, was to, once you had that first set of features that could support culture, then we could use culture to collect lots and lots more features that enabled us to take off compared to the other animals.
Okay. It seems like I'm pointing out a mystery that I'm not sure if you agree, like the mystery of why natural selection cared so much to make the human head and brain as big as possible. Like, do you agree that there's something that calls out for explanation?
There's definitely
there?
Like brains were valuable. So clearly at that point in evolution, clearly evolution was going, can I get a bigger brain here? That looks like a good deal. Let's figure out how I can get a bigger brain. And it reached the limitation. So I just can't get a bigger brain, but clearly plausibly bigger brains would be valuable.
It sounds like you're saying that whole return on investment, the reason why the bigger brain is so valuable, it sounds like you're saying, okay, you got culture, you don't need that much bigger of a brain for culture. We've got culture nailed down. So why do you think the brain kept trying to get bigger?
I mean, a standard social brain hypothesis is that, we had a complicated social world and there were large returns to more clever analysis of our social strategic situations. And that doesn't seem terribly wrong, but brains also probably let us use culture and take advantage of it more. So there's just lots of ways brains are good. Bigger brains are good. I'm happy to admit bigger brain. I feel like you're burying the lead here. This can't be our main disagreement about Foom, is just the idea that brains could be bigger and more valuable. I mean, of course I'm going to agree to that.
Well, I'm seeing a very important increase in intelligence, right, from apes to humans. And I'm seeing an indication that we're not that far away architecturally from having a similarly large jump in intelligence, right? I'm saying, wow, it's just a slightly bigger head. It's just a few genetic tweaks to get so much more IQ points compared to apes.
Why can't I just jump ahead and say, of course, AI will be eventually more capable than us in a great many ways. Isn't that the point you're going to make here?
Well, the point I'm going to make is that I was just trying to factor out this dimension, right, that I call intelligence, which to me maps to optimization power. I think I'm observing that dimension more than just having culture, but also a dimension of like, hey, we're smarter, right? Like we can model things, we can plot our way towards arbitrary goals.
If I accept that, then what? What happens?
Great. Okay. Well, let me introduce a term that I coined called goal completeness that I want to ask you about. So goal completeness just means that you have an AI that can accept as input any goal and then go reach that goal. And it's not like the whole architecture of AI is only for playing chess or only for driving a car. It can just accept arbitrary end states in the physical universe. Do you think goal completeness is probably a good way to think about future AIs that we're going to have?
I haven't so far, but I suppose you might have an argument for why I should. This is similar to the generality of language. That is, some people plausibly say that our languages are general.
Right.
Any concept can be expressed in them, and that's an interesting feature to say about general. You could say our brains with language are general in the sense we can express any goal in language and give a goal to another person in language, and then they could comprehend the goal, and they are inclined to help, then they could try to pursue that goal that they've understood that we've expressed in language. That's a plausible claim.
Yeah, exactly, right? So language does have this generality property. In fact, it's so general to the degree that if you have a chatbot, just by virtue of programming a chatbot, if it's a really good chatbot, then by virtue of answering questions really well, the question's going to be like, okay, great, I'm the CEO of a company. What should I do next? Right? What should I invest in? What should I build? How does the building work? So language is
simple. Somewhere with this. Assume we've got something with goal generality, then what?
Okay, great. So imagine that now that we've identified a dimension, right, like the effectiveness of a goal-complete AI, is it possible that the AI will just get much better on this dimension? And then to connect it to what I'm saying earlier, right? The same way that just a few genetic tweaks, just a few scaling in size, I believe that it made humans much better than apes at this goal completeness optimization property.
I would say eventually our descendants will be better at identifying, understanding, and completing goals. Sure. That's part of a generality.
Are you so confident that we can rule out a FOOM in terms of a recursive feedback loop where being goal complete helps you become more goal complete? Really,
I don't know why I need to rule it out. I could just say it doesn't look terribly likely because we can, we have a world of recursive improvements and they're somewhat rare. That is, we can look at firms all over the world, for example, trying to improve their capacities in a great many ways. We can look at people trying to improve their capacities. We see attempts to self-improve and we see that people use all the margins they can to self-improve, and that when improvements on some margins generally allow some minor improvement on other margins, but tight loops of self-improvements are rare. So
yeah, okay.
So you just have to convince me that this particular self-improvement loop is unusual in its tightness, in the sense that you just need this to improve itself and not a whole bunch of things to improve together.
So one thing that I think is common is when we identify some dimension that humans and animals have, and then we try to build technology to surpass humans and animals on that dimension, we tend to succeed quite rapidly and by quite a lot, right? So like on transportation, for example, if you just identify, hey, how do you get somewhere as fast as possible and transport as much weight as possible? At this point, we're far beyond anything biology ever designed, right? Is that a fair, robust trend?
I'll continue to say, yes, our descendants will be vastly better on us in a great many capacities, but
it's not just our descendants. If you look at the actual rate of this kind of stuff, it seems like the progress happens pretty fast, right? It's like the progress toward becoming as good as humans at vision. Okay, that one's relatively slow.
The world together improves and has for a while, but small fractions of the world don't have very much extra self-improvement compared to the world. That's the key innovation observation about humanity for a long time.
Yeah, okay. But just, I think I'm arguing for the sub point that we might potentially have, let's say where the brain was going to go. If you let the brain be twice as big, if you made the pelvis bigger, AI might get to that same endpoint within just a couple of years. Is that plausible?
What is this endpoint? I'm sorry.
The endpoint of if you got to continue the trend of how the brain of humans differs from the brain of apes by letting it grow bigger, which evolution didn't have that opportunity. If you just continue that trend, you might have something much smarter. Is it possible that AIs will go that same direction and be how much smarter evolution was trying to make us?
I keep saying and agreeing with the fact that our descendants will be much more capable, but you say this thing instead. And so you must have in mind only some things change and not other things change concept here. You're going to imagine only the pelvis gets bigger, but not other things. What's that only thing for AI? What's the only thing that improves about AI and other things don't?
Yeah, the only thing that improves is the mapping between a goal you can give it and the quality of the action plan, the effectiveness of the action plan to achieve that goal, right? The optimization power.
But why is that an only? Why isn't that just a summary of our overall capacities? I mean, you could just say the same about the world economy. World economy getting rich, another way you can say that is, if you want to do any one thing and you hold up $100, it just more successfully achieves any one thing with your $100 as the world economy gets bigger. That's a global feature of the world economy. It's not a feature of a local part of the world economy, the fact that you can achieve goals more easily, right?
But if you hold up a $100 bill in the year 2010 compared to holding up a $100 bill now, aren't there certain objectives that you can get much better now for that same $100 bill?
Well, the world economy doubles roughly every 15 years. So it's been 15 years since 2010. So yeah, you can get twice as much of everything now.
Right. But if you look at a specific thing that you want out of that $100 bill, like, hey, go make me like the best virtual reality experience.
Right. On average, you can get about twice as much 15 years later. Some things are exceptionally more. but other things are a bit less on average. When the world economy doubles, that means you get twice as much of everything.
Right. But a lot of times the quickest path to getting the best result isn't letting the economy grow around you. It's just calculating the best sequence of steps you should do.
I mean, that's part of how that $100 gets spent better is when you hold up, say, to hold $100 for a lawyer and the lawyer takes $100, he has a better way of calculating how to do the thing you wanted. You don't have to know how bad it is. But yes, a big part of how the world economy gets better is that the participants know better how to do things. How to calculate. Right.
I think the reason, you know, to zoom out, I think the reason we're talking about all this stuff is because I'm trying to convince you that there's a dimension, the optimization power dimension. And I'm trying to show you arguments why I think that dimension could be scaled very, very rapidly, right? Within, like, let's say a year, something like that, right? Like much less than a 20-year economic doubling time. Are you buying that at all?
You're trying somehow to factor this thing out from the general capacity of the world economy.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think it naturally does factor out the same way you can. It's like, look, transportation, right? Optimizing the speed of transportation, doesn't that factor out from the world economy?
Well, you can identify the speed of transportation, but just making transportation twice as good doesn't make the world economy twice as good. So you're trying to argue that there's this factor that has a self-improvement element to it, the way transportation does it, right? If you make transportation factor, that doesn't make it that much easier to make transportation easier.
Yeah. What if we hold that aside? Let's not even talk about self-improvement. What if just without self-improvement? I mean, what I'm arguing about evolution, if evolution got to make the brain twice as big, that's not even self-improvement. That's just a path of tweaking genes and getting a little bit of consequentialist feedback, I guess. But I mean, it's almost like copying and pasting the algorithm to generate brain regions might have worked.
I feel like we're running out of time here. So we should try to get to the meat of the issue, unless you think this is the meat of the issue. But you know, basically,
I think everything we've been saying is all, like, I think we've been going at a linear rate, knocking down meats of the issue.
But again, I gave what I described was an implausible scenario. You're going to try to make it seem plausible. Please start to do the best you can to make it seem plausible.
Oh, sure.
It still looks implausible to
me. So in terms of a specific scenario, so what worries me is I see a lot of headroom above intelligence, and I'm expecting that within a few years, maybe 20 years if we're lucky, or even 30, but very plausibly 3 to 10 years, within a few years, we're just going to have these machines that play the real world as a strategy game, the same way Stockfish plays chess. They just tell you what to do to get an outcome, or they do it themselves. And at that point, no matter what happens, no matter what regulation you do, no matter how companies cooperate, no matter whether it's multipolar, whatever it is, you now just have these agents of chaos that are unstoppable if they try, right? That's roughly what I'm expecting.
I have doubts about that, but I still haven't seen you connect that to the FOOM scenario. So how do agents of chaos make FOOM?
So it's possible that FOOM could, the meat of the FOOM, where they get many, many orders of magnitude above humanity, that might happen after the world ends in a more mundane scenario. I think it'll happen eventually. I don't necessarily think you need a FOOM for most of us to die or get sent back to caveman standards of living. But I just think, yeah, sure, eventually you use intelligence to keep improving intelligence. Yeah, that's going to happen too.
Okay, but the FOOM scenarios was a very local, very fast improvement. You and I both agree that capacity will just improve mm-hmm. from the long run. But now you're focused on people having capable agents to advise them on things and thinking that's a problem or something goes wrong in that scenario. Say we all just have much more capable agents to advise us. Sounds good to me.
So, yeah, I mean, imagine that GPT-10 says, oh, you want to make more money for your business? Great. Here's a script. You should run the script. And then they run the script. But of course, it has all these other ideas about what it should do. And now it's unstoppable. And it wasn't what you truly meant. Right. So that's the misalignment scenario. Right. That's not can it end the world. It's will it end the world. And we're talking about alignment.
Well, now you're talking about unreliable advisors. A world of unreliable advisors is different than a world of useful, reliable advisors. Initially, you're just talking about they're good at giving you good advice. But now apparently they're bad. Their advice is bad. So
we
might not predict a huge use of bad advice.
So I'm expecting that they'll be very good at getting an outcome that they're modeling as the target outcome. But I think there's going to be a game of telephone, a disconnect between what you've inputted into them and how you've trained them to interpret your input, and then what eventually happens being not what you actually wanted.
In our world today, as you well know, you know, the main suppliers of AI systems are large corporations that put them through a lot of testing and then a lot of monitoring of usage to look for problematic usages, et cetera. So if this world of even more capable AI assistants had been going through a similar level of monitoring and testing, then that testing would roughly show how much they can be believed or relied on, and we would rely on them to that degree and not more. And now, if we have somewhat reliable but not entirely reliable advisors that we rely on more but not too much, especially in situations where we're especially vulnerable, that still looks like a win world. Why is it such a problem if we have not entirely trustworthy but pretty good advisors?
So the problem is that these advisors output these point and shoot plans that you can just press enter to execute the plan. And the plan is just so consequential. It's this runaway plan, and it makes sub agents, and it has huge impacts. And you basically just have to decide, am I going forward with this or not? And you get disempowered in the process.
So we today have worlds of consultants like that. I mean, certainly like businesses already have many consultants they could hire, each of who could give them advice on various things, some of which advice could go wrong. And individuals, you know, they watch Once Upon a Time late night TV shows trying to sell them as seen on TV products, which, you know, might not work or work well. So clearly the world has long had to adjust to the possibility that various kinds of employees, advisors, consultants could have self-interest underlying their advice and recommendations and supports. And we have been learning to be defensive and wary about those things for a long time. Why will that whole process suddenly go wrong when AIs are the advisors, consultants?
Yeah, because they're smarter and more powerful, right? So if you're trying to figure out whether the person you're watching on TV doing an infomercial is scamming you or not, that's a much slower and lower impact process, right? There's no world-ending downside to being like, sure, I agree with your sales pitch.
Random people buying stuff on infomercials isn't a world-ending process. Why would these AIs be world-ending processes?
Because they will have the power to end the world, right? So if we're having the alignment discussion, that pre-assumes that these agents are very powerful.
But the whole point of them being agents is somebody has to trust them to delegate to them mm-hmm. and follow their advice, right?
And if you're already accepting the premise that they're that powerful, you really just need one person to run an agent that's not great for whatever reason, and then you're screwed.
So I don't understand that. That is, say we have a world of 10 million people using AIs for advice to do all sorts of things. One of them listens to a AI which bad advice. How does that end the world?
So it's not about the person listening to the bad advice. It's about a lot of the stuff happens, as you say, you're predicting everything happening on a faster timescale. So that's part of the problem is just the AI says, look, I have a bunch of things I can do. Do you want to play it out over 50 years? Like, if you want to beat SpaceX, do you want to do it over 50 years or do you want to do it over 2 years? And you can be the next Elon Musk. Press enter to beat SpaceX within 2 years. And it's very tempting for somebody to press enter.
And if they press enter, what happens? What goes wrong?
So the AI is getting us to the next phase of technology, right? It's fooming the same way that modern humans are doing a bunch of things that past humans couldn't fathom.
Wait, so now we're imagining the button is a foom button.
Essentially, yeah. I think you don't really have, it's not going to foom all the way, but even if it just fooms, even if it just pulls forward a few decades of progress into a few months, that's already a very chaotic environment.
But all these other people with their AIs could be pushing similar buttons, creating mm-hmm. their increasing capacities, but they are, mm-hmm. you know, rivalrous capacities.
Yeah, so I mean, I agree that you, well, so I mean, I agree you could have this kind of melee, right? Where like on the internet, there's like everybody's running their own virus that's trying to like seize as much capacity as they can on the internet. Like I agree this crazy situation can happen, but I don't see how that works out with humanity still maintaining a reasonable standard of living.
I'm really failing to understand what you're worried about here. I mean, I pointed out the foom scenario because at least that's a scenario I can comprehend and identify its parts, but I'm just not understanding. You're just imagining a world where there's lots of advisors and consultants available and that goes wrong because one of the things these advisors could do is advise you to push a button that then increases the capacity of something you control, which most people would typically do now and probably do then. And that sounds good because we just have all these increases in capacity of all these things in the world.
Okay, fair enough.
Is this your main point, that a world of people listening to AI advisors could go wrong because they could get bad advice.
I think that's not a good characterization, because get bad advice, it seems like there's going to be a step where the human slowly takes the advice, but more realistically, it's more like the human
authorizes bad projects under the advice of an AI, say.
Sure, but the authorization step is trivial, right? It's just somebody pressing enter, essentially, right? So the issue is just what the AI does when it has all this capacity to decide what to do and then do it and then repeat.
So AI agents with who need to get approval from humans for budget and, you know, free, you know, powers of authorization, sometimes they get powers and authorization that maybe would not be good advice, but some humans are stupid. But then what? So some projects go wrong, but there's a world of all the other people with their AIs protecting themselves against that, right?
So if the scenario is that the AI gets it into this head of like, okay, I need to go build myself the most energy to support my project, so I'm just going to beg, borrow, or steal, I'm just going to do whatever it takes to get energy. And if an AI is so much smarter than humanity, you can imagine simultaneously manipulating everybody on the internet, right? So suddenly it's like winning over humans to its cause, right? It's doing massive effects. I mean, it's got...
Well, if there was only one of them, but if there's billions of them at similar levels, okay. That is... I mean, so at the moment, you know, it's important to notice we live in a world of corporations, which in an important sense are super intelligent, that is compared to any one of us. Corporations can run circles around us in analysis of marketing and, you know, product design and all sorts of things. So each of us as an ordinary human are subject to all these potential super intelligences trying to sell us products and services or hire us for jobs. And how is it that we can at all survive in this world of these very powerful super intelligences trying to trick us? And they do. They do try to trick us. They try to trick us into bad jobs, buying bad products, etc., all the time, and they way outclass us. That is, whenever a corporation is sitting there thinking about how to make a commercial, how to design a product to trick us into wanting it, they're just so much better than we are when we think and reason about, gee, do I want this product, right?
So I think I agree with the part of your point saying, like, look, we don't have a single actor today that isn't held in check by a combination of other actors who share our values, right? Is that your point?
Corporations don't share our values. That's not
no, but they're, held in check. They're held in check by a combination of other actors or forces, right? Like, you know, if they, if they try to do something illegal to get our money, they might succeed.
Competition is a great discipline of not only corporations, but also governments, different people who might run the government, at least. So that is, democratic competition lets us try to judge among different people who try to run the government. Mm-hmm. Commercial competition lets us judge among different people who we might buy from or be employed by. That's the thing that makes our world work today, is competition among superintelligences. Why can't AIs function similarly?
So in our world today, the reason why a corporation doesn't run away and start destroying the world in order to get another dollar out of you, one reason is just because they know that the combination of other actors are then going to push back. Is that fair?
We know how they would push back. And the question is, why can't a... Why wouldn't, in fact, that be the default typical arrangement for AIs? That is, AIs would slowly slot into the spots that corporations and consultants are sitting into now, right? That's how corporation AIs would gain power and roles in our world, is basically they would sit into the same social roles, right?
So my scenario is that that balance is going to be disturbed, where we're going to have agents that they think that they can go do something, which they know that humans would love to push back on, but they also know that it's too late and the humans can't push back on it.
And what would that be? That, because are there such things in our world? Or if not, why does this world have such things in our world now does not?
So the key difference is just that you're going to have an agent that has more of this optimization power, right? Like bringing a band of human of modern humans into like an ancient tribe or an ape tribe.
But these super intelligent corporations already have vastly more optimization power than we do. That's not...
Yeah. But they don't have so much of it that they think that they can run away from humanity as a whole, right? So one corporation can beat humans, but they can't beat all of humans. And I think that that balance is going to change.
But one corporation doesn't have to just beat all of humans. That has to beat all the other corporations too. Same for the AI. One AI has to beat all the other AIs. So why will one AI be so much more capable than all the AIs?
So it sounds like you're open to the scenario where you have a lot of very powerful AIs running around fighting, but you just always think that that equilibrium is going to stay pretty good, right? Is that a good characterization?
I'm not trying to make strong claims like that, but I'd say we already have a similar situation. We already are monitoring for ways that could go wrong. We should continue to monitor for ways that could go wrong with the AIs, but I don't see a better solution than to wait until they're here and start to look for such things. I think it'll be very hard to anticipate them far in advance, to be able to guess how they could do things wrong and try to prevent them. For most technologies, the time to deal with their problems is when they are realized in a concrete enough form that you can see concretely what sort of things go wrong and, you know, track statistics about them and do tests about various scenarios. And that's how you keep technology in check, is through testing actual concrete versions. And the problem at the moment is AI is just too far away from us to do that. We have this abstract conception of what it might eventually become, but we can't use that abstract conception to do very much now about problems that might arise. We'll need to wait until they are realized more. But I don't know if you know that I have supported the concept of FOOM liability, wherein I'd say, look, if there's a way in which individual AI systems can go wrong, then what we should do is make their owners liable for whatever damages they cause and have an extra liability for however close they get to the bad scenarios. So to the extent you can identify the scenarios you're most worried about, we can make a checklist of factors, which makes it more likely they're near the bad scenario, than we just crank up liability near those bad scenarios, and that will just push everybody away from those scenarios. And that's a simple, robust way. And Eliezer himself said that that looks like something that could work. So I'm not seeing large chances of a problem, but I'm still happy to look for cheap ways that we could avoid a problem that might be bad, even if I don't think it's that likely, because, hey, why not? Take some modest mechanisms to avoid things that could go wrong. I don't think it's, but some other people think it's a problem. So I don't see that much of a problem with FOOM liability. That is, it looks like a relatively modest cost to deal with what, like, some people think is a serious problem. So why not?
That's great that we have a little point of agreement, because it's like, yeah, you have, you know, recently, I think Jan LeCun and a bunch of AI industry insiders were saying, we don't want to be held liable in case our systems break and cause damage. They were pushing back against some proposed regulation, and people called out some hypocrisy, because it's like, wait a minute, you guys are the people saying there's no issue, right? So now, now when it's time to say, hey, you have to pay us if there's an issue, you're saying that's going to handicap you? Like, what's going on? So
I mean, I think it's somewhat unfair that we often take particular things we don't like, and we want to set up extra liability regimes for them, but not for everything else. I think we should just have a more generic liability regime. And I think basically everybody should have to have liability insurance against everything.
Totally, that, yeah.
That's just and a simple, way, just a... not just AI or just guns or whatever you particularly don't like. Just have, we'll need to make our liability processes work a bit better, because at the moment they don't work quite so well. But it is a nice, robust approach. It's just a liability for damages, requiring liability insurance to everybody to make sure they can cover, and then let them try stuff.
Just want to give a shout out to the viewer. If you like that kind of institution design by Robin, he's got a bunch of different proposals for institutions that I think that's underrated. Exactly. You've made a similar point about why you expect to be able to live peacefully with AIs, which is you mentioned the rule of law, right? And you're pointing out, look, when you say, when you go to another human tribe, do you really care how much they share your values, or do you care if they respect the rule of law, right? You've made that argument.
Right. That is, mostly when we travel around the world, the thing we check for in whether we'll be safe somewhere isn't some poll of the people and their values and how aligned those values are with our values. That's not how we do it, right? We have systems of law, and we check for statistics about how law often is violated. And then we think, I might be at risk if law is violated here a lot, i.e. there's a high crime rate. And so to the extent that you can assure that the kinds of laws there are the kinds that would, you know, punish people for hurting you, you know, let you sue for damages, and then low crime damage rates would be enough to convince you that it looks okay there.
So what about a scenario like my grandpa's family, where they were Jews in Poland, right? So it seems like the idea that the society is going to respect the rule of law for them sometimes breaks.
Sure, sure. There are sudden changes in law that you might have to look out for.
Right. So, and how do we characterize, when does a weaker demographic tend to get
If you're
going to
visit somewhere for a week as a travel, that's less than a week. You're planning on moving there for retirement. You'll need to make longer term estimates about the rule of law.
That's true, that a Holocaust is only going to be a longer term effect. So you can always kind of dip in and out to places that have the rule of law for a long time.
Even in 1935, it might have been okay to just visit Germany for a week.
Right.
On a trip, okay?
Okay, fair enough. But you really think that AIs, we're going to be able to like have money that the AIs accept and, you know, and have property that they respect? That's like your mainline scenario.
It's also true for M's as well as AI. I think one of the biggest risks is that because we think of them as a separate category, we end up creating separate systems for them, separate legal systems, separate financial systems, separate political systems. And in a separate systems, then they are less tied to us. And then when they get more powerful than us, then they may feel less about disrupting us. I think the more we are sharing systems of governance, finance, employment, you know, relationships, et cetera, then the more plausible it is that they would feel ties to us and not try to kill us all. Yes. So
yeah.
I don't want these separate systems. I want shared mixed up systems. That's just a general best strategy through all of human history for limiting harm between groups of people.
Right. Okay. One more thing I got to touch on the topic of alignment is RLHF. What do you think about RLHF? Is that a powerful alignment tool in your view?
I haven't studied in the detail. The things I see as its results have been, you know, discouraging, but I don't have strong opinions. Basically, it's kind of a finishing school they go through. And, you know, the main thing we notice is how officious and, you know, submissive and, you know, even hypocritical they are as a result of this finishing school. And that's not really very conducive to the kind of conversations I might want to have with them. But it could be there's other ways in which they would just be obnoxious and uncooperative that I'm not seeing that this mm-hmm. finishing school helps. So I guess just like to see more competition in this world of finishing schools to see if we can, in the same way for regular human schools. Like there's a lot of professionals created by our major universities where I'm not that thrilled with such professionals. They don't seem that fun for me to interact with, but clearly firms like them and hire them. So I can't complain too much.
Right. Well, RLHF has worked well to make the chatbots into good consumer products, right? Because they've succeeded in the market with ChatGPT. But OpenAI is admitting that RLHF is not going to cut it when the AI becomes super intelligent. Anthropic is admitting that. So they're admitting that it's an open problem how to do the equivalent for super intelligence that we're getting today with subhuman intelligence, right? Does it concern you at all that they're admitting that alignment is an open problem and RLHF doesn't scale?
Not especially, that's the easy thing to predict. Yes, of course, all of these firms are going to admit any sort of criticism. They are eager to show that they are concerned. I mean, in the modern world, almost no firm with a product that some people think is risky wants to pretend, oh, there's nothing to worry about there. That's just not a winning PR stance for any company in our modern world. So yes, of course, they're going to admit to whatever problems other people have, as long as that's not a current problem with their current product to worry about. It's some hypothetical future version of the product. They're happy to say, yeah, you know, that'll be something we'll be watching out for and worrying about.
Okay. Last question. What is the event or threshold or warning shot that would make you concerned about rapid human extinction from AI?
I mean, the main thing I'm going to be tracking is automation of jobs. So if I start to see a substantial uptick in the rate at which job tasks automated happens, that will correlate, of course, with a substantial tick up in the amount of revenue going to the companies supplying that automation and the supporting infrastructure that they pay for, then that would show a deviation from trend. And then I want to look more closely to see how fast that's accelerating and in what areas that's accelerating. And that would be the places we should all watch more carefully. Wherever things are deviating from trend.
When you made that prediction about the $1 billion a year, you know, the bet with Alex Tabarrok that you didn't think AI would get to $1 billion a year, do you want to up it to like $100 billion a year and then you might actually get concerned?
I mean, I'm happy to just leave it continuous. But again, this is still a pretty tiny fraction of the world economy. $1 billion a year in a $90 trillion economy is still just a tiny, tiny fraction. So I'm really not, what we're going to look for is trends that might lead to much larger fractions. That's the thing we're worried about. You know, if we, one part in 1,000 of the world economy is still not enough to worry about its actual effects, but as a trend, it might be interesting and worth watching.
Here, one throw a proposal at you. If 5% of world GDP in 2030 or earlier is directly traceable to late generation AI, then you get worried about the FOOM scenario.
I get to pay more attention to trends when they deviate more from trends, so that there's no threshold of worry, not worry, worrying. There's just a degree of attention that should go to things as they become more strikingly deviant from what you expected in previous trends. So I will just pay closer attention. But again, I still think there won't be much we can do at the abstract level to constrain AI to prevent problems. We'll mostly have to wait until concrete systems have concrete behaviors and monitor those and test them. And the more capable systems get, the more we should do that.
Great. All right. Thanks, Robin. I think this was great. I'm so glad I got to ask you on all these different positions and update my model of how you see the world. What would you say as a wrap-up statement? How would you summarize where you've disagreed with me today?
I guess it would have been good ahead of time if you had presented the scenario you're most worried about. Maybe I could have read about that ahead of time, thought about it, and then we could have dived into the particular scenario, because I'm still not very clear about it. It isn't the same FOOM scenario as I thought you might be focused on. So, that may be for some other day. But basically, there's a value in general in all these conversations where somebody summarizes their point of view as concisely as they can and thoughtfully, and then the other party reads it. So I guess I had some things like that for you, but I didn't ask for that from you. And yep, maybe that would be good enough for you to do. Maybe you should write a little essay with the scenario you're most worried about, lay it out as clearly as you can. And maybe that would be a way to refine your thinking and then be easier for other people to talk to.
That sounds good. Yeah. And I feel like that's similar to requests that Doomers get pretty often. So I'll definitely go back and see what I can do on that front. All right, everybody. So Robin, where would you direct people to online?
You can find me on Twitter at Robin Hanson. I have websites, hanson.gmu.edu. That's it.
For the audience, I know I've focused everything today on how I disagree with Robin, but in general, I actually think that his body of work, like I said, is some of the most influential. Highly recommend checking out grabbyaliens.com and just go to Robin's website, just browse around. I think you'll be quite impressed with a lot of that work. Well, all right, thanks very much, Robin.
Okay, take care.
Wow, Robin is super generous with his time, not only with me, but constantly for years with all kinds of interviewers and even critics. While I couldn't disagree more with his position on AI doom, as you saw, I have the utmost respect and appreciation for the way Robin engages in high-quality discourse. It's all too rare to be able to say that about someone, that he consistently engages in high-quality discourse. Can't say that about many people. In fact, Robin is the only prominent non-doomer so far who has offered to debate me or accepted my offer to debate. And yes, I have been making offers. That speaks volumes. Last thing, the point of this podcast is to spread awareness of how bad and how urgent the AI doom situation has gotten for humanity. If you feel the same way, you can do your part by sharing this episode on social media. And if you haven't already subscribed to Doom Debates, did you know it's as easy as 1, 2, 3, 1? Go to doomdebates.com to join my Substack. 2, go to youtube.com/@doomdebates and click subscribe. 3, search Doom Debates in your podcast player. That's it. 1, 2, 3. Thanks for your continued feedback, support, and constructive criticism. And I'll see you on the next episode of Doom Debates.